to the stage, your first comic of the evening. He is the host of podcast Highway Diary. Give it up for Eric Hollerback, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Keep it going for Chris Lane. What a beautiful man. What a great show this is.
Yeah.
All right. Enough of that horse shit.
Welcome to Highway Diary. My name is Eric Hollerbach. With me is Xander Forrest.
Hey!
We've become quickly friends, you know? I keep seeing you at all the mics I go to. It's like, hey, what's up, homie? We're brothers. We're soldiers.
Yeah.
How long have you lived in New Orleans now?
I've lived here for 5 months. It's been nice. My family's from here. It was the first city I got drunk in when I was 12.
I think that's a lot of people have a similar experience.
Yeah, when Ripley's Believe It or Not was still in the quarter, and my mom sent me out because she was too wasted to go with me, so I got a daiquiri, and then
you just said, "Hey, sir, can I get a daiquiri?"
Yeah, nobody cared, and
they
were
like, "This Bourbon Street motherfucker, you got cash?"
Yeah, and there was still like visible prostitutes, not these like fancy escorts that we have now.
Oh.
It was very seedy. I went to Ripley's Believe It or Not, and then I left, and these two prostitutes apparently were trying to have sex with me. I don't know, but these two ladies of the night were trying to draw me into an alley, and then this guy that was just walking by pretended to be my dad, and then that creeped me out more than these girls that had their tits out.
So the cover story of the prostitution and how the deal gets done.
Yeah. And then he took me back to my hotel and scolded my mom, but she was too drunk to remember the next day. So,
that's a problem with yelling at dead beat parents. It's like, are they gonna remember this?
Absolutely not.
How was your upbringing?
It was good. I didn't have a dad. He was around, but like, my mom told me when I was raised by a single parent. And I have a sister. My dad has, like, two kids that I just don't really know. But, like, my mom, when I first started doing stand-up, I, like, moved to Portland when I was, like, 20. And then she came to visit when I was, like, 22. And she saw me do stand-up for the first time. And it was, like, a show I was headlining. But a bar show, so I just got drink tickets. It's nothing important. But then we, like, bonded after, and she told me that I was a rape baby. Because I told her that when I was in a punk band when I was a teenager and I moved to Tucson from Phoenix, Arizona. I was like 17. I was like, the whole time I was there, I was a junkie. But like, I'm telling you this because I'm not that anymore. And then she cried. And then she was like, the reason I let you do whatever you want is because you weren't supposed to be here. And I was like, what does that mean? Was I supposed to... was I an abortion that didn't work out? Like, what happened? And she's like... no, your dad raped me, and then I had you, because he, like, kept preventing me from getting rid of it. I'm like, huh. Well. Sometimes you're destined to turn out into a giant piece of shit, and it's just, you have no say.
So you are a junkie on heroin?
I don't think you can be, I mean, you can be a junkie on anything else. I feel like heroin's, yeah. Heroin's
so
the only...
What, so that saved you at a point? Certain point, how did you get hooked? What was the first one? Was it oxycodone or what?
No,
was the
it
first
was heroin.
Delivery system?
It was heroin.
You smoked it or you...
Yeah, I smoked it the first time. So I was in a punk band from I was like 15 to 18, and we got like locally successful, and we were bigger in Tucson than we were where we started in Phoenix. So the band broke up when I was 17 and I moved to Tucson. And then I lived with a bunch of, like, crust punk anarchist people. And one of my roommates who was in a band I was joining, they were called Molested at Church. So, there's that. I had done it. I had, like, smoked it before. And then I found out that my roommate had some. And I was like, well, let's do that then. And then just got real hooked into it. Stole a car for heroin. It's a good time. Crashed it, but that's whatever. And then, I quit. I saw Trainspotting and how the dude, like, locked himself in the room. and then like that's how he's gonna like withdraw and get over it. I did that, but like I had a bunch of ice cream, but it was Arizona and it was like the summer, so and we didn't have air conditioning, so I locked myself in a room, like I reversed the doorknob and I was like, don't let me out for 2 weeks, I'm trying to like not do this anymore. And but I locked myself in my room with like very perishable foods, like ice cream and like cheese products and like bologna and shit. Mm-hmm. And so after the second day, I just had nothing to eat except for like canned green beans. And like, it was terrible. So I was just shitting in buckets and like throwing up in the same bucket next to food that was like rotting. And just, it was terrible.
That's a Kafka-esque way to get out over a smack, it's, right?
You were it's like one a, way to do it.
A hunger artist, right? Yeah, a shit artist.
It is, yeah.
It's just an art piece of mm-hmm. your sobriety.
Mm-hmm. I made a lot of Jackson Pollock paintings with my mm-hmm. asshole that no one will ever be able to appreciate. So.
Let me tell you this about Jackson Pollock. You know, a lot of people can shit on a canvas, but only if it says Jackson Pollock in the corner. Is it worth $1 million? So what are you going to do to get your name up? What you got to do is have furious effort towards your goal. You have to make something undeniably amazing.
And you have to die before you're successful.
How is the, speaking of that, how is the NOLA comedy scene treating you? We've had a lot of conversations. We're both... I feel like also we get along because we have similar styles.
Yeah.
We kind of have... We're kind of like sex joke, dick jokes. That's kind of our wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. You absolutely. Know?
So I think absolutely. We're kindred
My
spirits.
My whole comedic career has been based on a foundation of dicks.
And you know, it's interesting because my friend Puneet Lakhmani was actually talking to me earlier about how I do too many dick jokes and how I'm selling myself short. And maybe he is right about that. But, you know, I feel like it's... I
don't feel like there's too many.
I kind of have that same sense. Like, if you're doing a new dick joke, okay, it's like one piece of anatomy. What are you possibly going to say about it? If you have a new one, that's something, you know?
Yeah. There's never too many
dick How jokes. Is the NOLA comedy scene treating you? Do you want to name names? Do you want to burn all your bridges now?
Not yet.
I'm giving you that opportunity.
Not yet. What I will say... One thing I like about it here is that it is... Most places you do stand-up, the open mics suck and the shows are great. This is the first city I've ever been in where the open mics predominantly have at the very least as much as a crowd as a lot of the shows. It's very well attended. It's also because of the tourism here. That's great. But so that's the one thing that's like kind of turned me off is like the people that run and go to open mics here are a lot more humble than the people that run shows. And a lot of the time it is the opposite. It's like the people that run the open mics are upset because they're still running an open mic that sucks. And then the people that run shows are like just so stoked that they don't have to host an open mic anymore. Here, and I don't want to say anything specifically, but, and it's not just myself, like other comics I've talked to, is it's like, if you're not from here, but you moved here and you're not on a tour, people that run shows throw you a lot more shade than people that run open mics, and that's like typically the opposite. So, but then also there's been some weird open mic things that have happened here. But I don't, overall, everyone's very funny, but for a city that like makes its money off of drinking 24/7, too many people here take it way too serious for where they are and what they're doing, and I think they could do the opposite.
You're saying there's a overestimation of everyone's ability. If people run a show, they overestimate their abilities.
No, I think that people here kind of, I mean, I don't want to say anything like, oh, somebody's not funny or anything. I think everyone here is very funny and there's like a good scene, but like what I will say is that for the place that we are, which is New Orleans, and it's fucking crazy, and there's no other place in the country like it except for Las Vegas, which is worse, people, especially people that are telling jokes, should take their setting more to heart than taking it more serious than they should. You know, like, people throw up on the street like it's a fucking hobby here. And if you're gonna take a comedy show seriously in a city that smells like piss because some fucking frat dude from South Carolina came here for a bachelor party, like, just calm down a little bit.
Is this a conducive place to grow? Are
yes.
there people that are, you know, supportive of the struggle? Are we all in it together, or are there cliques? Are there mean girls? You know.
Yeah, well, there's always cliques with comedy because, like, for the most part, people that did do stand-up were, like, were not popular in high school, and this is their way of being popular. And so there's always going to be those weird cliques, and there's also going to be the things where it's like people have been doing it longer. They're watching people come up faster than them. They're watching people that are younger than them come into a city when they've been doing it longer, and they're getting more attention than they've gotten in, like, 10 years doing the same open mic for that long. And that's not conducive for harboring talent, but this city itself is because of the fact of the drinking and the tourism. It's like, most of the time, most of the cities you go to, the stand-up thing, whether it's an open mic or a showcase, is, or a comedy club or whatever, like, that's the thing they're doing that night. Here, everything is the next stop. So it's way better for growing talent because you don't, you walk into cold rooms less here because of the fact that people are already drunk, and you don't have, it's like, you are set up to having a better set and be able to explore yourself and what you want to talk about more freely because of the fact that, like, you're not, if you're going first on a show or a mic, people are stone cold sober in other cities because that's the thing they're doing. That's the first place they're drinking at.
Mm-hmm.
Here, people are already drunk, so they're like, yeah, I'm at a comedy show. They understand jokes are going to be happening. So they're already warmed up and you don't have to do anything. It's like, great.
I will say that, like, compared to Los Angeles, the open mic scene in New Orleans, like, has civilian audience members.
Yes.
Routinely.
Yeah.
Even the show at Black Label Ice House, I mean, there's probably, like, 10 or 15, 18, almost 20 people that are just watching the show, there to watch the show, you know?
Yeah.
You just came from 12 Mile. You were saying it was on fire over there.
It was great. It was, and that's the other thing about New Orleans, is so amazing. A lot of the times you're in cities, if you're doing a show or a open mic, they're like, they're all separated. So you'll go, this is like the safe space LGBTQ room, this is the black room, these are the 27 white guys in hoodies rooms, and then, you know, and that's how it is. But here, it's like every, it's the most diverse scene I've ever seen for comedy. I haven't done one open mic where there was just one group of people. Like, one type of group of people.
You're saying that happens in Portland?
Oh, that happens everywhere. But especially in Portland, every room you do is white. Yeah. Audience-wise, unless you, there's, like, maybe three black rooms. And then that's the thing that sucks, is, like, most of the country, there's the quote-unquote black rooms. And that's because of the weird alt hipster scene of stand-up that's, like, getting more prominence. But, like, it shouldn't be that way. There shouldn't be this, like, oh, I can't do that mic because, like, they're not gonna understand my fucking Nintendo joke. Like, in Portland, a lot of the thing you see is, like, white dudes talking about gentrification and, like, whatever, and then, but they are, you know, and, like, feminism and things, but then they don't want to do the black rooms because they don't think they're gonna laugh, which is, like, this weird inherent subconscious racism. It's like, you think these people aren't gonna laugh because, like, you feel like they're culturally different, and then that they are on par with the things you're opposed to, but you're also the reason that their mic is fucking 50 blocks from where this show you book is, because you moved here from San Francisco and you pushed them out. So it's like, it's shitty. New Orleans is great. Every single show I've gone to, every mic I've gone to, whether, even if it's comedy or anything, there is as many white people, gay people, black people. And that is why, too, I feel like it's, like, really good for creating talent, because you're not just talking to your cul-de-sac. You're not talking to your cool part of the mall where, like, the van store and the fucking whatever else is. It's like you're talking to everybody at once. And that's how you become great. You become mediocre by only talking to people that agree with you. You become better by talking to everybody that has every different opinion. And here you have that.
Yeah. I love it. I've had problems with people in the scene who I feel like they didn't like my style. You know, I do things that can be construed as transphobic. I do things that can be construed as name your special interest group phobic. But, at the same time, I go from black room to white room to this room to rock and roll room to this room. And I feel like that's what makes me better. Even if I try the same jokes and it works in this room, but it doesn't work in this room. It's like I want to do shows at like a fucking Chinese restaurant.
Yeah,
I want to do shows at a Thai restaurant. Everything.
And that doesn't mean it's not funny if it doesn't work at one.
Right.
But there is a thing where, like, there are times where, like, you're going to be in front of people that just, that's not what they want to hear. You know? Like tonight at 12 Mile, it was a lot more liberal leaning people who a comedian went up and was talking about having sex and stuff, but from a cisgendered male perspective.
Oh, what privilege.
And it didn't work because. In any other setting, it would have been fine. And I don't want to say that there was, like, a certain type of crowd, but it was a crowd that was more leaning to hearing things that were opposite to that. But you can go up and be like, oh, this crowd's stupid or, like, whatever, and be shitty and then not grow. But or you can have that and be like, oh, well, the next time I do this room, I'm going to do something that's not the typical thing. So.
What's so interesting is, like, they want to know where you're coming from. So it's like, if you're coming from a place that's, like, misogynistic, this and that, then they might kind of categorize you. But if you come at it from, like, such a... You have to reveal your humanity.
I always apologize.
You reveal your character in such a careful way. So that it's almost like you have the authority to speak on the subjects that you're about to speak upon.
Yeah, and for me, I do everything from, like, stories of weird sexual encounters, mostly story-based stuff, like drug use, things like that. But then I also have things where it's political in the sense for, like socially political things, like feminism and things that... But anytime I talk about things like that, I instantly am just like, I look like the person that, like, grabbed your friend's ass and then said a racial slur. I know how I look. And then that's how I get away with talking about those things is, like, well, one, I, like, relate to it, and that's important to me. Not grabbing girls' asses and saying racial slurs, but, like, feminism and, like, everyone being treated equally. But... You have to acknowledge, like, how you say things and how you look and also the room you're in, because if you just go up and don't read an audience and you just, like, act as if they know you already, you, for something that should not be perceived as being misogynistic or racist or sexist or homophobic or ignorant or anything, could have been avoided if you just take ownership beforehand of, like, the situation. And, like, a lot of comics, I feel like, could do themselves and their audience a favor by, like...
Addressing the room.
Being more present.
And meeting the... like, understanding that this is a room full of this kind of people or whatever. Yeah, and then
and
just,
not,
like...
And not entirely I'm, just see that and be like, oh, this is what I'm going to do because this is what I want. Or this is what they want. But just, like... Seeing what they're laughing at, seeing not being like, oh, they look like this, they want to hear this, but, like, you can get a gauge, especially when you've been doing stand-up long enough, of, like, you're around people enough, you're around different opinions and ideas and people enough that at a certain point, if you've been doing it long enough and you're still not taking those things into consideration and just being like, granted, yeah, do what you want to do and like harbor your own voice, because it is, at the end of the day, like you're the person that's creating your career. But also, like, if it's an open mic, even a show, but like you have to take in all those little nuances and like vibes into consideration before coming across seeming inconsiderate or disrespectful for a thing that like could have easily been avoided by just being present while you're waiting to perform.
We're continuing now with Xander. You just performed at Siberia. How'd it go?
It was great. Good time.
Let's talk about our relationship a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, there are these wayward people in the comedy scene who kind of speak. I think before you met me, you heard the Anthony Weir. From Hi-Ho.
Yeah.
Podcast. See, here's the thing.
I heard that after I met you.
Okay. When I sent it to you on that
one? Yeah.
Okay. See, this is a weird thing I'm in. After the Band from Hi-Ho episode 133, I feel as though I burned so many bridges so fast.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what bridges you could have burned, but like...
the content.
Yeah. But also, nobody... I mean, that's the reason why, like, so many systemic things stay being a problem is, like, from...
people not
If your truth is feeling alienated and ostracized, you should be able to say that without...
further repercussions.
Yeah, I mean...
it's like, for me, it is a fact that I cannot perform at the Hi-Ho open mic on Sundays. That is a fact. And then I feel like there was a further insult to injury when I said that that was a fact. Yeah. Instead of sweeping it under the rug, saying nothing, and then pretending like everything was glorious, maybe I would be unbanned. But because I made such a stink about it, because I thought it was such horseshit that I make fun of somebody after they make fun of me and then I'm banned from the club... I think that there's something very important I need to say about how comedy actually works and from someone who's been doing it since 2002 versus someone who's been doing it since 2011. So...
But that's the thing, like, you know, there's egos and things you have to deal with. But
for sure.
There is that thing where it's like... I stopped doing stand-up for 2 years because for way more extreme reasons than... that, but there is this thing where there is a, it is a business, and a lot of people, from what I've learned from fucking up my own self, is there's that guilty by association thing. So if you would have, which you handled it the way that you did, but if you would have done it in the way that like that happened and you apologize and just suck a bunch of dick and whatever, like you're supposed to do, it would have been fine. But I also think that if somebody is upset about something, they should be able to say it without other people becoming involved just to save face with some person that they think that can do them more favors than the person that felt upset, you know, with anything. You know, with like if a girl is working a job and she gets sexually harassed by her boss, but like if he's the one giving her a promotion, she's not going to look at those ass grabs. But then if she says something like, no, this dude grabs my ass all the time, and most of the time because of the country we live in, you're going to get fired for, they're going to find some way to spin it because they're going to protect the institution, not the person. So it's like, I don't know, you're an asshole if you say something, you're an asshole if you don't. It's like...
This is my big dilemma, because, like, on a certain aspect, I really believe it's important to have to run the scene a certain way in order to be permissive of other people's styles. Well, if someone is an insult comic, if someone is a dirty comic, if someone is a clean comic, if someone's a feminist comic, they should be the best version of themselves.
And that's... permissive. That's the thing that offends me most about comedy is that other comics should be a lot, should take it a lot less seriously, because everybody's bombed. Everybody's tried to figure out what their voice is. Everybody's tried to figure out what their thing is that, like, they want to make people laugh on and what their angle's going to be. And to dismiss somebody because you don't know them and you saw them do something, maybe it was offensive, maybe it just wasn't funny, whatever, and then to just instantly be like, oh, this person has no potential and they're going to cause problems, and then treat them as such.
So
it's
let
like,
me
it's
shun
not
them.
Fair. That is not, yeah, it's not fair. We've all been in positions of being unfunny and unliked and learning, and if you do some shit on an actual show, whether it's a comedy club or some show at a bar, and you bomb or you say some shit that someone got offended by, okay, then yeah, you might have fucked up, because it's a professional setting, there's money involved, there's like people paying the rent off of things, I get it. But to ostracize anybody for anything that's said at an open mic, unless they're just being like, brown people should die, yeah, fuck that person. They shouldn't, no, don't do that. You're gonna ostracize our audience. But like, if somebody just goes up and they're trying, we all know what we're all trying to do. We're all trying to make somebody laugh. You can tell if somebody's making a joke. You can tell what they're trying to get to, even if they don't get there. And to treat an open mic set as a thing where, like, oh, you just can't fucking perform anywhere. It's like, well, then why do we have this? Why? Chris Rock bombed his first 2 years. He was banned from Caroline's, I'm pretty sure. He's banned from a lot of mics because he sucked so bad. And if everybody just never gave Chris Rock a chance, we wouldn't have the greatest bit, I think, is $5,000 a bullet. That's one of the most, like, he combined social commentary with also humor in a way that it wasn't just, like, annoying and political. It was great and hilarious. He got to that point from being...
From failing.
He was still banned, though. He still got banned from comedy club. He got banned from places. Like, people wouldn't let him go.
Richard Pryor, too, consistently.
Yeah, they were so consistently terrible. But it's like, you can't... David Cross brought up the first... I think it's the first time Dane Cook did stand-up, was Catch a Rising Star in Boston. And David Cross brought up Dane Cook. And was just like, this guy's not, this is terrible. Didn't like him, whatever. Both of them became famous, which is the thing that strikes me the most, is that, and it's the thing that I feel like more comedians should take to heart, is it's like, this David Cross, who's like the alt comedy god, brought up a guy who still became a comedy god. Like, he sells out arenas. I mean, he's probably more successful than David Cross is. But, like, he didn't like Dane Cook when he... The first time he went up, didn't think anything would happen. And they still... You can't... There could be somebody that goes up and says the N-word the wrong way, and then they could be a person you're going to be begging for stage time in 5 years. So it's like, let people at an open mic figure shit out and try and be funny for the sake of it. And to act as if, like, oh, you fucking insulted the host or whatever. We're all just trying to be funny. And to just, you can't, in this business, you can't just write people off, because at the end of the day, somebody's going to go past you faster. And that could be the person that offended you. And then a month, a year, 5 years, 10 years from that moment that you got offended and said they can't do your show again, they could be on fucking Conan, and, like, you're going to be begging them, like, you're going to wish you weren't a dick. So, like, let people be a dick, but don't be a dick to them. Let people just figure shit out. Everyone grows at different levels, and to just be so smug and shitty about things is annoying.
See, I love when people make fun of me on stage. If someone's on stage,
I love it.
For
me, that's like, oh, we're friends.
And I don't agree with all, like, hardcore, different gender fluid issues. I think most people who are gender fluid or have very obscure sexualities are narcissists who want attention for their tastes.
Okay, and I don't agree with that.
It's like, all. Oh, you have an obscure taste. Wow. Well, are you working today? Do you have a job? What's happening?
But the reason that those people are so vocal about that is because of the fact that, like, they've been ostracized and alienated and haven't had a voice for so long that that's the reason now why they're being so adamant about making their voice heard.
Yes.
So
I think there's a large segment of people who will go, okay, you like that in your ass. Who cares?
But they care because that's their truth that they felt they were never able to talk about openly, and now there is the platform for that. So to a degree, I do understand where you're coming from. We're like, I'm from Portland. I know people who are just doing things because that's what's cool. And there is that does exist. But predominantly, we live in a time now where everyone can have their voice heard and people are taking advantage of it. And I think it's a good thing. But, like, it's also that thing, though, too, where, like, you don't want people to see what you're talking about and just judge you a certain way.
Right.
And there's people that talk about whatever they want in their ass or whatever. And you shouldn't look at that.
I know, but I'm saying I look at the craft of joke writing. I think overall what we're doing is the craft of joke writing.
Yeah, it's making people laugh.
You know, and so however people come at that, everyone has their own infinite different experience, infinite different point of view.
Yeah.
And if they're true to themselves and they work hard on their joke writing, I respect it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about our relationship a little bit, and then we're going to continue on Bar Redux. I feel like we both have had similar experiences as far as feeling ostracized. You were saying that you quit doing comedy for 2 years.
Oh, I lost all my friends. I got kicked off festivals.
From what scene? What city?
Well, Portland and Austin. So I got in a fight in Austin with a comic who is a lovely person. Nothing bad to say about him. We got in a drunken fight and it got crazy. I was also living there with a girl that I was engaged to. We were doing coke. I was very, very, very deep into bulimia at the time. So I would just throw... Basically, I was malnourished and only lived off of cocaine and alcohol. That's going to make anybody crazy. I get in a fight. Went to jail. He said some things. People instantly took his side, and that's fine, whatever, happened. Got kicked off of a few festivals, got kicked off of a few shows that I was booked to do, and then 3 months after that, I'd moved back to Portland, like, right after that fight, like, around then. The girl I was seeing at the time, I left her in Texas, because we just weren't good for each other. We fought all the time. We were crazy. We would be physically violent with each other. That's a thing that happened. And I was also 23, and, like, it was just, it was just a shitty time. And then, so I left her there, went back to Portland, started dating a different person, and then the day after I posted a photo on Instagram of, like, me with my new girlfriend, my ex, who I left in Texas, posted a thing. There's, like, a female comics whatever on Facebook. And she had been in Portland for 2 months. We hadn't talked. Nothing happened. And then the day after I post this photo, she goes on this thing saying she posted some photos, you know, with, like, bruises or what. I never saw them, but, like, the photos. And then he's saying I just, like, beat the shit out of her all the time. And, like, I was just this, like, violent wreck. Which, like, I'm not going to say, like, I never hit her. Like, we got into fights with each other. It was, like, not a mutual thing, but, like, we just weren't good for each other. It was terrible. Like, it was a bad time. And also with the fight that happened with this comic, like, I was spiraling out of control. And then that was the thing. Both of those things combined, people, like, you know, decided that I was, like, a threat or whatever, and that I shouldn't be allowed to be around people, and, like, it's fine, I shouldn't have. Like, I needed these last 2 years to, like, get my shit together and, like, figure out who I am as a person and, like, tone all of my problems down. But at the end of the day, none of these people that judged me and, like, everything that happened, they weren't there for either things. They weren't there for my relationship, and they weren't there for the fight. And for people to just so instantly just, like, pick sides is, I don't know, it pissed me off. And then I just stopped doing stand-up because, like, in Portland, anytime I would go up, nobody would intentionally laugh. They would, like, leave the room. And I'm like, you fucking, you're just, like, doing this because that's what you're told to do. This is, people got, took themselves off of shows that I was on, and then later was like, oh, it's just business. It was just business. So, like, You're not on the side of this because you feel any way about anything. It's just like, oh, you don't want to be on the show with the guy that you could lose shows from. And I lost a bunch of friends and, like, my career. Like, I did Sketchfest and, like, tons of shit. And was, like, on the trajectory of, like, not having to live in a living room and work at a hot dog stand like I do now. And so I just stopped for 2 years. I was just like, I don't care. I don't give a shit. But then I can't not do stand-up. I don't give a shit. If someone thinks I fucking beat women and, like, just fight people for no reason, they can fucking think that. I don't care anymore. Because I want to be a comic. It's the only thing I know how to do. And I don't know. At a certain point, it's like people, anybody that's, like, great is, and I'm not saying, like, I'm great, but I'm anybody that's, like, makes waves from, they're always the people that have the biggest. Andrew Zimmern, who hosts that, like, fucking Weird's Food thing, before he got that show, he was a fucking drug addict living in an abandoned warehouse in New York, robbing old ladies and stealing their purses. Anthony Bourdain was a junkie chef. Like, there's so many people. Tim Allen was a fucking felon. He got arrested with, like, 5 kilos of cocaine on him, and then he got out of jail and became a comedian. Like,
you're saying it's like, it's the job of last resort. It's like,
it's
something.
It's the thing. There's a thing about
greatness
with kitchens.
In stand-up.
There's always a felon in a kitchen, and with comedy, the funniest people are the biggest train wrecks. Richard Pryor set himself on fire making crack. Like,
yeah, like, I read his autobiography pretty recently.
Yeah,
and
he was a nightmare of a person. Like, he beat women. And not, I'm not saying that, like, oh, it's fine. Like, don't hit anybody. Just don't be an asshole. But, like, there is some fucked up thing about art, whether it's culinary or performance-based, that the best people are fucking crazy. And even the worst people are still as crazy because they're yeah, attracted to this thing. And to just, I don't know, man, like, everybody, like, Bukowski was a fucking flame, like, a terrible misogynist. And there's this fucked up thing with art that it's like, anybody that's already famous, they get a free pass. Derek Jeter has given everybody herpes. Nobody fucking talks about it. Because he's Derek Jeter and he's a Hall of Fame baseball player and he's amazing.
Hey!
But if your friend just gave everybody herpes, you'd be like, that guy's an asshole. He's giving them all herpes. But if you have a fucking World Series ring or whatever they get for sports winning, then it's fine because you're successful and it's like,
you got that Jeter dick, huh? That's a good yeah, side effect to the herpes.
Yeah. My ride is walking away, so I...
Right. All right. Let's pick this up Tuesday. But I think we made some good headway here.
Definitely did.
Very healing. All
Eric,
right, Xander.
I love you
too.
What are you doing?
I'm gonna go. I'm gonna go jerk off and go to sleep, and then I got meetings with my professor tomorrow.
All right. Well, I will see you tomorrow night.
Yes, sir. We're continuing on. This is day two of recording this podcast.
Second half
with Xander Forrest. Wow, we were going into some hardcore stuff. We were talking about your past drug use. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going on a bender and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I want to say that you grabbed my penis, but I forget what show that was at.
More than one.
That was a couple times.
My favorite thing is sexually assaulting men because it's like...
There's less lawsuits.
Well, one, it's like, I think it's the best way to see if, like, you can actually be friends with someone, like, depending on how they react to them... getting their dick grabbed apropos of nothing, because it's a very vulnerable moment, and dudes aren't normally typically, like, sexually assaulted by other men. And I like doing it out of, like, a social thing of, like, you know, because, yeah, like, women get groped and fucked up all the time, and I just, like, I love just grabbing dudes' dicks and, like, seeing how they act, and depending on how they act, it's, like, it's how you can tell if someone's actually a good person or not. The dudes, when you grab their dick and they freak out, probably a rapist.
Well, just
you
like,
are very nonchalant. A lot of people are nonchalant, but the guys that like freak out are the ones that's like
homophobic.
Yeah, they're terrible people. They're terrible people. Because honestly, if somebody grabs your dick over the pants and you're flaccid and it's just at a bar and it's like obviously a joke, if your first reaction is to be mad and try to fight, you've probably have put your dick next to somebody that didn't want it there, and you're very aggressive about it, you know? So that's how I gauge people's characters. Like, I'm going to touch your dick several times throughout the whole course of our friendship, and if you freak out one time, I'm going to ghost you, you know?
You're right. You try to text him, it's over. You know why?
You got weird.
I already gave you the test.
Yeah, you got weird. But you've handled me touching your dick very appropriately, and you didn't freak out.
Thank you.
And I don't think that you're a rapist. I don't think that you're a rapist.
That's so nice. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's the greatest compliment I've ever got.
You let a strange white man touch your dick, and you were fine about it, and I feel like you're a decent
person. When it's like you right next to your girlfriend, it's kind of like, what's going on here?
Oh, yeah, my girlfriend has seen me touch more dicks than she's probably touched, so...
Well, I thought it was only appropriate just to grab you back, just to be like, look, I'm not going to get mad dogged like that without repercussions.
Yeah, definitely. And I will be like, yes, it is there.
That is fair.
It.
That was fair.
That's fine. That's okay.
That's legal.
But the second somebody freaks out, that's when I bail. Yeah. That's when I'm like, I don't trust you.
An eye for an eye, a grope for a grope. You know, we're homies. You know,
tip
this
for
is
a
just
tip.
Living the life.
Yeah. It's fine. It is fine.
So, yeah, we're at Bar Redux, Young Funny Show. This is the bingo night. You know, we were just talking before we started recording that, like, there's something about bingo night, but there's also something about this show where it's kind of always controlled chaos.
Yeah.
Gigi goes out. She starts whipping people.
Oh, it's great. It's how any performance-based thing should be. It just be... Because that's what's going to fix our country is, like, the reason why most people are assholes is because they're, like, sexually repressed and, like, and also they're, like, very uptight. And so comedy and bingo and sex toys, that should just be everything. If any poetry slam, somebody should win a vibrator.
Right.
Every comedy show, somebody should get a shot in their mouth with a dick syringe, which is what I had happen to me tonight. And you know what? Made me a better person. It made me humble, and it was nice. There's also a black dick syringe, and you know what?
I saw that apparatus, but I came in after the
so it's like it was
at.
Like a so it's like a black dildo on top of like
a plunger,
like a syringe.
Yeah,
and then it shoots a shot of alcohol in your mouth, and it was great. It made me a better white person, and I can now say that I had liquid shot in my mouth through a black dick, and that's important. You need to do those things. You need to go past your comfort zone, you know?
Speaking of which,
it's important.
Speaking of having hot load shot in your throat, what was the weirdest thing that you did to get heroin at your worst? Like, what was the thing? Did you steal money? Did you do this?
That's the thing is, like, I've actually done worse things to myself just to get off for no reason of, like, getting high or anything, just because I was, like, sexually frustrated. But with heroin, and it's funny, people ask me that all the time. They're like, oh, did you, like, steal from your mom or, like, suck dick or whatever? The worst thing I ever did for heroin, and it wasn't even that bad. I stole a car, which I loosely talked about on the last half. But my drug dealer, I wanted heroin. I didn't have any money. And so my drug dealer had leased, but he basically sold his car to a friend, and the guy was supposed to make monthly payments on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a drug dealer. He has more than one car. He's fine. But the guy never paid him for it. So he was like, go get me this car. I'll tell you how to hotwire. It's my car. Drive it back, and I'll give you drugs. So I, you know, it takes me a very long time to, like, figure out how to get the engine to go, but... steal this car, and then the first thing I did after the engine was going was, like, I should probably smoke some heroin right now. And I nodded off while I was driving back to my drug dealer's house, crashed the car into a ravine, was real bloody, had glass in my body. It was just really bad. It was like a actually fucked up car wreck. And then I had to walk 3 miles to his house. And this was like before, this is like when people still had to use MapQuest. Like people had cell phones, like the Razor or the Sidekick and like iPods, but like there wasn't GPS on your phone. So I had to just go off of like memory. It took me like 2 hours to walk 3 miles to this dude's house. Just kept getting lost. I show up. He answers the door like in Pulp Fiction when John Travolta brings Uma Thurman. He's like, no, bring her back to life. It was your drugs that she snorted your heroin. Like he answered his door in a bathrobe. It was like, the fuck are you doing? And there was just like passed
out. You're like covered in blood.
Yeah, he's like 40 and there's like passed out 16-year-old girls with their titties out and shit. And I'm just like, what the fuck? I'm just like bleeding profusely, and I was like, dude,
it's
I like
it's a simple scam. I told you to steal my car for the insurance money.
But that was the thing. I was so worried. I thought that he was gonna like kill me. And he was like, dude, I just didn't want that guy to have the car. He was like, is it totaled? And I was like, well, it was on fire when I left, so probably it's like flipped. It's like there's not a car there. I had to crawl out of a glass door. It was terrible. And then he was like, and I was like, hey, I just like came here just to tell you what happened. And like, I know you have like a medical kit. Like, can you like patch me up? And I still got the drugs. So, you know.
Well, I guess he felt
no one
bad
really though. Got hurt.
It was
because it was his own car.
Right.
And really, the only person that got fucked up from it was me because I crashed it because I nodded off. I was strung out and then. Walked fucking 3 miles just bleeding. There's probably a fucking trail of blood from like
Jesus.
Yeah, it was bad.
Ravine, where what state were you in? Portland?
No, it was Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So just like some like road crew just like later on comes across the car and goes, what the fuck?
I told him where it was.
You called the road?
Yeah, because I told my dealer where his car was because it was next to this like Mexican food place that's like really popular. And I was like, dude, it's like, seriously, if you pass that, if you're going like east, you're going to see it on your left. Like you're going to see the car because it's like that close. And then nothing ever happened. Like there's no legal ramifications or anything. It just, I got drugs from him, and then like a week later was when I was like, I should probably not do heroin. This is probably not good for my life.
So like flipping the car,
yeah.
And the glass.
So
was that the last time you did it, or was it? Did it? That
was
just
the last
first
time.
Seed of like. This
well,
is not
I did it
good.
A few more times, and then a week after I quit, because I saw Trainspotting like a month before I stole the car, and in Trainspotting, this dude, Ewan McGregor, I think. Is like the main guy, and he is a junkie, and he quits heroin by like locking himself in a room with like supplies and shit, and because like he was watching his friends die and they were living in a squat, you know. It's like my whole life was that movie, and I was like, I don't want to die from this. So then I locked myself in a room like a week after I crashed his car, and then and then I did it, like, twice, maybe, from, like, 19 to now. I've probably smoked heroin twice, but it's really one of those things that, like, once you're just, like, aware of how shitty it is. I mean, granted, intravenous heroin use, like, you know, a needle in your arm, that's, like, a way more, like, concentrated feeling. So that's harder to... And I did both, but when you smoke it and you haven't in like a year or two, it tastes like burnt ham. Like, it's really bad and like salty. And you just like kind of want to throw up forever, but like, you're not depressed anymore. It's just not enough to like, to fall back onto. So I did it twice, and both times was just like, this is just gross, and like I feel like shit. If I shot it up though, I'd probably like be one of those people that like overdosed and died. Because, like, with overdosing on heroin, it's a thing where, like, you build a tolerance, and then you're shooting up, like, a certain amount, and then you stop, and then you shoot up that same amount you shot up when you were, like, in it for keeps, and then you die because your body, like, can't handle that amount
right.
anymore.
That's
so,
interesting.
Yeah, so...
It's like alcohol, you know? Someone can get to a place where they're drinking 5 pints of vodka a day.
Yeah, I drink, like, typically, like, a fifth a day. I have a really bad drinking problem. But if I don't drink for a week, I'll have one shot and I throw up.
Right.
But then... And then I'm hungover and I feel like shit. And it's this fucked up thing where it's like... I like drinking for stand-up because it makes me more... Not myself, but I'm so introverted and, like, high anxiety. Yeah, and, like, my brain just runs so fast. And that's also, like, why I did heroin. It's, like, it slows everything down. With, like, alcohol, I can, like, be... I can actually say the things I want to say without being convoluted by, like, 7,000 other thoughts. But then it's also, like, I don't want to fucking die when I'm 50 because my kidneys are failing. So I'll, like, try and stop drinking for, like, a week. And then I'll go from one night of, like, taking 12 tequila shots to get drunk throughout, you know, a 6 to 10 hour period to having 3 shots of whatever liquor, and then I'm just throwing up in a bathroom crying like I've got drunk for the first time.
Seems like everything is about pain management. It's like, what can you handle pain-wise, like emotional depression? What is it? Why are all comics so depressed? What is going on?
And the thing I've always, like, tried to find an answer to is, like, why is it that, like, all the funniest people are the saddest, most fucked up, like, scourge of the earth fuck-ups? Like, what is that? Like, Robin Williams killed himself. Robin Williams, like, before I knew I wanted to be a stand-up comic, Robin Williams was a person that I was like, I want to do that. Like, I'm sad all the time. Even, like, being 9 and seeing Flubber, I was like, I want to be funny.
Energy.
And, like, I love Mork and Mindy. Like, that was the first sitcom I ever saw. And I was like, that I remember seeing. And I was like, this is so funny. Like, I want to make people laugh. And then I found comedians like David Tell and Doug Stanhope, where it was like, Robin Williams had this manic stage comedy. And then David Tell and Doug Stanhope had, like, depressive, morose comedy that I was also as attracted to. But, like, Robin Williams was, like, the first guy. I was like, I want to, like, make people laugh because I'm so sad. And then he fucking kills himself. And, like, there's a lot. Like, Hunter S. Thompson killed himself. And he wasn't a comedian, but, like, he was a comedic... He had a comedic prose with the things he was doing. And it is... Stand-up's weird, like... Most of the time, the best people are these fucking nightmares. Like, shit shows. Like, what is it about, like, I feel so shitty about myself, but if I can make someone else happy, everything's fine? Like, is that what it is? Like, what is that thing where it's, like, everybody who's, like, the best at it is just distraught? And
like,
just
Richard Pryor lighting himself on fire.
Richard Pryor, like... His mom was a prostitute, right? And he, like, grew up in brothels and, like...
You know, I just wrote a paper...
Still, and the only thing he could do was just be like, if I can't make people laugh, then that's it. And it's like, what the fuck is that? Where it's like, that's... The funniest person at a house party could not do stand-up.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the weirdest thing, is it's like... I mean, they're probably not going to be important. Like, the person that likes, like, the class clown or whatever usually is, like... That's, like, the Dane Cooks or, like, the Jeff Dunhams or something in my mind. But, like, the people that become prominent is, like... They should have never wanted to make people have the joy they didn't have. But instead, there's this thing where, like, you want people... You want to make people happy because you never were. And it's fucked up.
Let me ask you this. So I just wrote a paper about Richard Pryor. I have a couple things I want to say. So Richard Pryor, when he was young and in the ghetto, it was such a fucked up ghetto
that
he came across a baby in a shoebox that was, like, aborted, you know? And so
in my opinion, he always knew, like, oh, shit, I'm from the same area that this baby came from. I could have easily been this baby in the shoebox, so I might as well go balls out trying to do what I want to do. The other thing I want to say is I'm doing an independent study in stand-up for my master in screenwriting coursework, and I wonder, like, are the best people at stand-up, like, if this course were to last at UNO, like, what if I become famous and then they're like, oh, let's teach this course that he did, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, is that the best way even to make comics, is to write papers? Like, can you teach this shit in a college?
No.
You know what I mean? Because it's not like
And that's the thing that's most offensive to me about, like, comedy classes and things, is the worst thing you can do as a comic is have anyone else influence your voice. And that's why, like, the best people... Richard Pryor didn't go to a fucking comedy class. Richard Pryor didn't...
He
was, like, tortured and wanted to, like... And that's the thing. It's, like, Bill Hicks, Richard Pryor. There's tons of people where it's, like... If I can make people laugh, that's fine. You can't learn how to be funny. And it's a fucking con. Anybody that's, like, oh, this is the fucking formula. This is... You can do it for one-liners. Granted, yes. I will say that, like, if you want to fucking have jokes and be, like, fucking Jimmy Carr or even David Tell, it's, like, one-liners, but, like, you can learn how to do that. You can definitely learn the formula and the rhythm of, like, a setup punch joke. But to like, bury your heart on stage and be someone that's as prolific as, like, Louis C.K. or Chris Rock or Richard Pryor or George Carlin, that you can't learn that shit. Like, you can't. There's, like, no thing you can... Someone can tell you, like, oh, this is how you, like, transcend your insecurities and, like, being able to, like, make people relate to your, like, sorrow or whatever. There's not... Nobody can teach you that. You just have to be so troubled and so driven to, like, not be troubled and just have to be around, like, positivity, and that's what's gonna, like, make it work. But, like, comedy classes and, like, courses and, like, things, theorizing, like, what does this mean? How does it work? You can have that. You can have that aspect. Like, you can analyze comedy and be like, oh, well, this is, like... You can look at irony. You can look at metaphors. You can look at things that, like, was happening when Shakespeare was around. Like, that, like, will elicit a laugh from somebody. You can definitely study that. But you can't learn how to fucking be funny. Like, you can't. Yeah. It's, like... That's the shit that pisses me off. You'll see a comedy club's like, coming on Tuesdays, we're going to have stand-up class. It's $175. It's going to be a 10-week course, so it's going to be $1,000, probably closer to $2,000, and you're going to get a 20-feature set, and you're going to be on your way to fame. It's like, no, it's not. Nobody that's ever fucking got successful did a fucking stand-up course and, like,
well, let me put it this way.
You can't fucking teach that shit.
What, there's something very tricky going on because also, like, I'm in screenwriting workshop. But what we do is we read each other's screenplays and we submit each other notes. So how a screenplay is not is very analogous to a stand-up performance.
But, and that was the thing that I was saying, is, like, there's people that are inherently funny. Like, nobody can tell you how to be funny. With screenplays, there's things like dramatic irony, there's irony, there's so many other things. Like, you can write in a scene that will be funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nobody can really teach you how to do... I mean, you can learn the things of, like, what makes something funny, which is, like, a bait and switch. It's a flip. It's like, this happened and then this happened, and wow, that's ironic. That's funny. You know, like... It's the bait and switch thing with, like, is how one-liners work. It's like you get a thing and then the laugh comes from the flip of, like, not expecting something to happen that did. So screenwriting, I feel like it's actually easier to be able to learn how to be not only a comedic actor and a comedic screenwriter. It's easier to do that than it is to have a career doing stand-up and just being funny. Okay?
I really think, like, the stand-up's the hardest shit ever.
It is the hardest, and we get no fucking, like, credit at all for any of it, because people are like, oh, well, if you're so talented, like, write a screenplay, write a book, like, you know, like, because it is words. We're saying words, we're writing, but it is that thing where it's like, it's the court jester thing. It's like, you're here to make the king laugh and then whatever, but and then it's like, then there's like the playwrights and things that is like more like well-to-do or whatever, but it's easier to write comedy for, in the sense of like a TV show or a movie or a play, those like comedic points is way easier than going on stage with your own truths, being personal to people and trying to make that funny.
Let me tell you something. And
so you can learn that. You can learn how to write a funny screenplay. You can definitely learn that. There's things you can look. There's like,
I still when other people would submit screenplays and they're like, this is a comedy, I'd be like, bitch, what the fuck do you know about that shit? Do you know I'm hammering my ass out every fucking night?
Yeah.
What do you're not doing that? Well, that's to call, if I submit a comedy screenplay and someone else it does, it's like not the same thing even, because it's like they're not doing comedy. In my opinion, if you're not a stand-up, how dare you call yourself a comedy writer?
But
you know what I mean?
But that's the weird thing about it is like you have sketch comics that never do stand-up and they write sketch, like Workaholics. Like they,
yeah, that's a funny show.
Yeah, or like even Derek Comedy, where Donald Glover came out of, like they were all like he was kind of doing stand-up, but like
there he did is a little, but is, he came from
there,
improv.
There is this fucking weird thing where like somebody can write genius fucking sketch comedy. There's probably been hundreds of writers for Saturday Night Live that have come up with like sketch bits within SNL that like we've probably like Will Ferrell doing the fucking more cowbell thing for Blue Oyster Cult with like Christopher Walken. That's one of their like most famous things. Somebody probably wrote that like never did stand up before. Like that, like even Jonah Hill, like the first time he did stand up ever was for the Funny People thing. They all had to write their own jokes, so he would perform jokes that he wrote, and it was like terrible. He bombed all the time, and then he figured it out. But like, he got famous from doing sketches in New York, and then I forget the guy that played Captain Hook in Hook.
Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman's kids saw Jonah Hill perform a sketch bit in New York, and then he got his big break on I Heart Huckabees, which Dustin Hoffman mm-hmm. was in. And then from there, Jonah Hill has gotten his career and, like, you know, met people that, like, it worked out. But, like, there is a weird divide where, like, a lot of stand-ups don't know how to transition from them being able to be funny on stage to being able to write something that'll be funny for like a TV show or whatever. And then there's people that can do sketch and write screenplays that are fucking really funny, but like if they try and do stand up it's like terrible. So like there's a weird, like, you can know how to be funny on paper and you can know how to be funny on stage. Sometimes you can do both, but like I don't feel like you can learn how to be funny in front of people. I feel like you can learn how to be funny on paper and like plays and screenplays and sketches. There's things you can look at that are like just textbook like bait and switch things, but I don't think anybody can learn 100% how to be funny on stage from somebody else. That's shit you have to learn on your own, but you can definitely have somebody teach you how to write something that's like comedic and is like a play or something, you know.
So Xander, let me ask you, you moved here to New Orleans, what is your goal, what is your scam to get paid doing this shit? I think you are like me right now, we're both like kind of incubating our talents, we're trying to get better and better and better.
I
using New Orleans as a training camp.
Yeah,
as
I a want college. Next summer I want to do, I'm going to take some of that was on my album, because my album is only 34 minutes, and I want to take parts of that that I still think are funny, but like build on it. And then I'm going to take another 30, like I want to do an hour special and then like find somebody that maybe will distribute it or something. But I want to do that. And then I have like two ideas for like TV things I want to do. But like, I don't have like any sort of like, oh, I want to be famous within like this time. There's like things I know what to do. Like I know that I want my rent to be paid from stand up. And I also know that like I don't want to like act like I have an idea for like a apocalyptic comedy I want to do, and like a travel show like along the lines of Anthony Bourdain, but it's, you know, like there's a lot more tattoos and like drug use involved, like a combination between Anthony Bourdain and like David Tell's Insomniac. Like I want to combine those two things and do something like that. But like my goal is just I want to put out an actual special, and then somebody think that it's good enough that like they distribute it, and then anything outside of that is like totally fine. I don't care. But
cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, I will be releasing my Kickstarter campaign to fund my first stand-up special called Conspiracies and Dick Jokes. Look out for that Halloween. Anything you want to say before we wrap this bitch up? This has been quite a journey.
I have an album on iTunes. I like woke up the poorest I've ever been today. And then, so I put my album out. It came out when I was like, it was like 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And I put it out through CD Baby, and they put it on like Amazon and iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, YouTube, like everything. And like intermittently, like today I woke up, I had $5, and then I got an email from them saying I had like $100 from like royalties. And I was like,
yeah, so that's drinking dope. Money.
So I've made less than $1,000 off my album, but it's
What's
on,
it called?
It's. So I go by Xander Forrest now because I'm trying to be a different person than I was before, when we talked about in the first half about how I like lost my career. I went by Xander DeVoe. The album's called Obsessive Repulsive. It's not bad. It's fine. I got $100 today, so that's good. But I have a Pandora station. You can listen to it there for free, or it's on Spotify, iTunes, and yeah, it's
Xander
fine.
Forrest.
That's all I want to plug.
Obsessive Repulsive. It's been another episode of Highway Diary in the motherfucking bag.
Yeah,
it's been Eric Hollaback with Xander Forrest. Later, bitches.